Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In Missouri last night, another night of protest accompanied by some violence. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up on the show, Ferguson in context, its historical echoes and the long march for racial equality, what's different this time, and what that tells us about the realities of class and being Black in 21st century America. We'll also look at credit scores and how a recent change to the FICO calculation might actually raise yours. Also, the obesity crisis and our love lives. Author Sarah Varney is here to talk about her book about the ways our relationships are changing along with our larger bodies. We'll look at a new report on the state of special education in New York City. And finally, it's everywhere, including on the Brian Lehrer Show today, the Ice Bucket Challenge. We'll look at why all these people are dumping water over their heads and what it means for charitable giving today. And now we go back to Ferguson, where many of us, this small city of 21,000 people, is the next chapter of the long struggle for racial equality in the United States. Many of us are asking what it means and how to put it into context. Regular listeners know that Tufts University historian Peniel Joseph has been joining Brian for a series on the 50th anniversary of several incredibly important civil rights era moments, the March on Washington, the JFK assassination, the Harlem riots, and more. He's been putting those moments in context of the present for us. So this morning, we're actually flipping the script, looking at what's happening today and comparing them to the racial confrontations of the 1960s. Ferguson, Professor Joseph wrote recently, is a wake-up call. It's one that exposes a generational divide in leadership when it comes to civil rights in this country. We'll speak with him in a minute, but I want to first bring in Ryan Riley with the Huffington Post. He was one of the reporters arrested in Ferguson last week, and he was on the streets of Ferguson last night, along with the Missouri National Guard. And I want to check in with him about what he saw on the streets. Ryan, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So last night, protests began peacefully and didn't stay that way. What happened?
They were. You know, early on in the night, we essentially saw protesters moving down, up and down the block here. They were told by police officers that they had to continue moving, always moving. In fact, one 73-year-old I actually was able to interview who had trouble walking but wanted to be out here for the protest, was moving along, albeit slowly. But essentially, that's what all the protesters were told. If they kept moving, they wouldn't be under arrest. But as the evening wore on, there were some conflicts, and people began stopping up by the line of police officers, and it turned into somewhat of a chaotic scene. And actually, many of the journalists in the area here eventually would end up getting hit with tear gas by the end of the night. It would waft in because, I guess, of the wind pattern to the state media staging area we had down here. So it was very much so a sort of chaotic situation. One thing I would note in comparison to previous nights were there was a lot fewer cars on the street because they had sort of shut down the area, which made things a lot easier, I think, to a certain extent. But you still had a lot of people out here on the streets who were not clearing out when originally told by officers. And so there were some methods used to try to get them out of the area.
Was it clear to you watching what the National Guard was doing?
Actually, the National Guard was still back by the command center. I don't believe, as far as I know, that they were ever actually deployed. We still saw the same vehicles and regular police vehicles out here, although they are very much in a military style to a certain extent. But it was not the sort of National Guard presence that I guess some of us had anticipated. They were still based in the command center.
They were still based in the command center. Of the people who were protesting last night, do you have a sense of who they are? I've seen reports that they're from as faraway places as New York and California and have come to Ferguson. Who were on the streets last night? Were they nonviolent protesters? Were they people looking for trouble?
Well, you know, it's tough for us journalists to sort of identify the people who are causing the most issues, because often they're not they're in the middle of the action, and they're not obviously very willing to identify themselves. But that's what a lot of that people who are protesting and trying to peacefully protest here are contending that these are outsiders. You know, I've heard with people from Oakland and other cities you mentioned who are allegedly trying to rile people up. And what you did see last night, a really interesting moment that actually I spoke with a gentleman who caught video and was able to view the video of a local politician here who's been sort of at the front lines of many of these conflicts and trying to de-escalate the situation, actually give someone that he, I guess, claims was etching the situation and appeared to be really confronting and walking directly up to the front of the police line, a really good shove and sent him sort of flying backwards and trying to get him out of the situation. You had other groups that were essentially trying to act as a peacekeeping force and were on megaphones and were instructing everyone to go home and get out of the situation.
So protesters themselves acting as peacekeepers, you said?
Yes.
And was there, you mentioned someone shoving, but did you notice conversation happening between people who were looking to confront police and others who were trying to hold the line?
Yeah, that was, I think, what we saw essentially the entire night. We saw that playing out. There were people here who were trying to get people to go home. But obviously, once you deploy tear gas, a lot of those people who are trying to keep this a peaceful situation are going to sort of get out of the area for the most part. And it's, you know, it's strange also because the people are anticipating that tear gas is going to be deployed. You have a lot of people wearing masks, but also journalists, I mean, frankly, are walking around here with gas masks on, which I imagine, you know, from the side of police officers is sort of a strange thing to look at, because if you see someone with a gas mask who's trying to avoid getting hit with tear gas, the assumption would be perhaps that they were a protester, but that's not simply not the case. Some of the people who have the most equipment and some of the bulletproof vests on are journalists just trying to protect themselves and cover the situation. And that was one of the troubles, I think, that we saw later on in the evening. I believe only the second night that we've actually had a separate press area. And previously it was pretty strongly guarded and pretty highly regulated in that you would have to identify yourself and have some sort of credential media to get into that area. Last night, that was just simply not the case. And a lot of there was simply a yellow tape that didn't prevent any of the people from the crowd from mingling in with the journalists, which, of course, most of the people who mingled in with us were perfectly peaceful. But it made it difficult for officers later in the evening to identify exactly who was journalists and who wasn't and who was allowed to be in that area. And eventually they just cleared all of the press out and sent us back to the command center, which, of course, made it difficult for us to witness anything.
About what time did that happen?
Subsequently. You know, I wouldn't be able to say offhand. It's been a long few days. I wouldn't want to guess. I think it was, I know I got back to my hotel around 1, so I would venture that it was probably around, I think it was in the 11 o'clock hour before midnight.
And I mentioned that you were one of the reporters arrested while you were filing at a McDonald's last week. We saw reports that a Getty photographer was arrested last night. Do you know anything about that particular arrest?
I do. I saw that arrest take place personally, and there had also been, I should note, reports of other, I believe confirmed reports of other journalists who were arrested as well. But in the case of the Getty photographer, from what I observed, there was a police officer who was talking with him and then called over several of his colleagues, indicating that he was going to take the photographer into custody because the photographer was not walking. That was sort of the deal with when you're out here, just as the protesters had to keep walking, so did journalists. If you were stopped walking, you were told to move along. I did not see if the Getty photographer indeed was sort of standing his ground there or how long that took place. I didn't see that aspect of the conversation or the confrontation, but I did see him being taken into custody.
And finally, you said last night that it was a new approach. There weren't as many cars on the street. The National Guard was in town, but you said you didn't see them directly involved in the confrontations with police last night. But any sense of what the approach might be tonight? They've tried so many different things.
I think we're going to see something similar, at least early in the evening. Actually, one person that I spoke with out here, who's a Ferguson resident, has been protesting on several nights, indicated that he thought it was sort of working earlier on in the night, and that indeed walking around sort of wore the crowd down, especially during the daylight hours. It was very hot out here. There isn't as much, typically we've seen a lot of water bottles being handed out. There wasn't as much water available, so the supplies were sort of dwindled. And in contrast to previous nights where it's essentially been a party atmosphere along the street, you've had people drinking, smoking marijuana, up to 14 people packed on top of SUVs. So it was a much different situation last night when it was simply pedestrians walking up and down the sidewalk and not blocking the street, simply protesting and demonstrating under the close eye and close watch of officers here.
All right. Ryan Riley, justice reporter for The Huffington Post. Thank you so much for calling us, and thank you for your reporting from Ferguson.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
And now Peniel Joseph joins us. He's a professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. And he's the author of Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and Stokely, A Life. Professor Joseph, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you just heard Ryan Riley describing the scene in Ferguson last night. I want to ask you, when you hear these visuals of what's been happening in Ferguson, Missouri, where do you think of the parallels? Is it Birmingham in 1963? Is it the Harlem riots? Is it Rodney King's verdict and the riots in L.A. after that? Where do you see the closest similarities?
Well, I mean, Ferguson is such a small city that when we think about the civil disturbances of the 1960s, we usually think of big major cities like Detroit and Newark in 1967, or, yes, parts of New York City in 1964. But I think when you think about Ferguson, it's such a small city, you have to think about places like Cambridge, Maryland, both in the early 60s when the National Guard was there, but also in 67, York, Pennsylvania, just smaller cities where there were civil disturbances. Because by 1968, Lyndon Johnson's Kerner Commission, which is basically the riot commission, they track, you know, hundreds of civil disturbances in hundreds of American cities. And so when we think about Ferguson, you know, this is not Watts, this is not Los Angeles. First of all, the violence hasn't really reached that kind of pitch, fever pitch level. I think what it's more similar to is the way in which Southern law enforcement in the 1960s really maintained segregation through police brutality and overwhelming physical force. So we saw that in Selma when peaceful demonstrators were routed at the Edmund Pettus Bridge March 7th, 1965, which is known as Bloody Sunday. And we also saw it in Birmingham when the city commissioner, Bull Connor, unleashed German shepherds and fire hoses. And just like now, it's the images that are really powerful, because I think what occurred last week when we saw the really hyper-militarization on the streets of Ferguson, and we saw folks in camouflage, and they were pointing live ammo at American citizens, something that, you know, you're really not supposed to do unless you're in a war-type combat setting. I think that's where you see certain parallels with some of the worst racial uprisings of the 1960s.
Speaking of Birmingham, I want to play a clip from our show yesterday. This was Pastor Tracy Blackman from the Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant, Missouri. She was present during the protest in Birmingham, and this was what she said yesterday.
The anger feels very similar. All of this is the outpour of people who have been ignored and who have been oppressed for a very long time. And this is the opening that has allowed them to express their feelings and their rage and to be seen and to be heard. I believe it is Martin Luther King who can be quoted as saying that rioting is the voice of the unheard. That's what we're experiencing. And so there are similarities in that. The difference is that the protests in Birmingham, Alabama, were very strategic, and they were coordinated, and they were planned. It wasn't just a march. It was a unified front of what we're marching for, what we all want, more specifically than just saying we want justice. What does justice look like? We want unity. What does unity look like? We want peace. What does peace look like? What do we want for the Brown family, and what do we want for the people of Ferguson and beyond that? what do we want for African Americans all over?
So that is Pastor Tracy Blackmon speaking about the conversations and big questions in Ferguson, Missouri. So the difference, she says, there is that in Birmingham, it was a planned demonstration, part of a broader strategy and a larger campaign. So what should we think of in terms of what might come of Ferguson without that?
Well, I think what she says is true, but I think it's more complex now in the sense that, you know, one of the things I wrote about in The Root is this idea of a civil rights generational divide. And on the streets of Ferguson, there's been a lot of cross-generational solidarity. What I meant by that divide is that there are millions of uneducated and undereducated and unemployed African Americans in the United States who don't see the quest for civil rights and racial justice through, quite frankly, a middle-class lens or a lens that's connected to history and education and a very sort of specific version of American democracy. They just realize that black folks are getting shot in the street, that they're unemployed. They face real racial hostility whenever they step outside of the segregated lines in their segregated existence, right? So whenever they encounter any kind of interracial contact, it's through the criminal justice system, right? So they don't have white friends. They don't go to college. So there's a divide there because no one is really talking about their issues at the national level. I mean, there are some leaders who try, but I'm saying that, you know, to be honest, in our contemporary context, you don't have African-American leaders, you know, Black Panthers, Stokely Carmichael, Angela Davis. You don't have that kind of leadership that's representing really the hopes and dreams of folks who UEP Newton called them the brothers and sisters off the block, people who are connected to the criminal justice system. Obviously, Malcolm X became their spokesperson in the 1950s and 60s. So lacking that, what you see are people, you know, there's a young man who says that we have no leader and our leader is Michael Brown, right? And these are folks who are not going to commit to the discipline of nonviolence. And there's a historic trajectory here. I mean, King faced protest in Birmingham where people weren't part of the Birmingham movement, even though Birmingham had a strategy. There were people throwing Molotov cocktails in Birmingham after whites had been assaulting black demonstrators. And these black folks weren't necessarily civil rights activists. They just were angry. And they were angry about the unemployment and the segregation in Birmingham in 1963, right? So the interesting thing about Ferguson is that it really challenges conventional civil rights works and strategies. And one of the things I wrote is that young people who are outside of the system, sometimes people call them a racial underclass. These are victims of what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration. They're not necessarily comprehending all of the progress, in quotes, that everyone keeps telling them we've made racially, mm-hmm. right? Because the progress, whether it's Barack Obama or black folks in the Ivy League, Jay-Z, Beyonce, wherever you want to look at the progress, LeBron James, it's not trickling down to their day-to-day existence. And that's what we're saying. So the divide has to do with, you know, how do you explain racial equality in the age of Obama to folks in Ferguson who are living below the poverty line? How do you explain that? How do you explain police brutality and hostility? And at the federal level, you've got Eric Holder, who said some good things, but, you know, the president had some remarks yesterday that weren't quite particularly inspiring. So it's business as usual in terms of the underlying problems of poverty, brutality, poor education, unemployment. And what we've seen in St. Louis with counter demonstrations and what we've seen with the Ferguson authorities is that there's a real anti-black racial hostility out there, especially against poor black people. Poor black people.
You mentioned the president's remarks yesterday and that you found them unsatisfactory, and we will play a clip of that in just a moment. But I also want to invite listeners to call in, and we want to hear about your reflections on how this fits into history. If you were a witness or a participant in the fight for racial equality in the 50s and 60s, what are you thinking as you're watching what's happening in Ferguson? The phone number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What seems similar to you from 50 years ago? What seems very different? What do you hope for in terms of what you see as missing, as catalyzing and taking advantage of this moment and this attention? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So here's about a minute of what President Obama said yesterday in his remarks about what was happening in Ferguson.
Part of the ongoing challenge of perfecting our union has involved dealing with communities that feel left behind, who, as a consequence of tragic histories, often find themselves isolated, often find themselves without hope, without economic prospects. You have young men of color in many communities who are more likely to end up in jail or in the criminal justice system than they are in a good job or in college. And, you know, part of my job that I can do, I think, without any potential conflicts is to get at those root causes.
So to get at these root causes of a community's feeling without economic prospects, that gets at the class divide that you were speaking about in the black community and the absence of leaders in Ferguson. But I was struck when you were mentioning leaders who were able to speak to disenfranchised poor people in the 1960s and 70s. You mentioned Stokely Carmichael. You mentioned Malcolm X. You mentioned leaders who were from the streets and who could talk to people. Hasn't it been some time that we haven't that we've been without a leader who was able to do that, to cross that class divide?
You know, I think we have those leaders at the local level. I mean, this is not to suggest that. I think every single city with a predominantly or a good number of black people has local folks. I mean, Chicago, you've got Dream Defenders, and you've got local spokespersons who are very, very articulate and eloquent. I think what we haven't had is any of those leaders have an ability to transcend the local and be at the national level, right? And part of that has to do with the corporate nature of our lives right now, where, you know, in our contemporary context, the Black Panthers wouldn't have a television show on MSNBC, and neither would Stokely Carmichael. So we don't have those voices projected in the same way. We didn't have them after the Overtown Rebellion in 1980 in Miami, or Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1992, Cincinnati in the early 2000s, and now Ferguson. But at the local level, those folks are there. But when we think about mainstream civil rights leadership, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, it's not to say they haven't done outreach, but they don't have the resources and the bandwidth. That's why what we need at the federal level would be a massive urban renewal plan, which President Obama didn't say. I mean, even rhetorically, if he had said that, that would have been more inspiring. Because the problem for Obama is that he's shown bold words only when he's campaigning to be president. So in 2008, I mean, he was hugely inspiring to all, right? But then once you reach office and you see the limits, not just of presidential power, but his own personal imagination, there's not the critique, because he said tragic histories, but it's a tragic present. This is not just historical. So Ferguson, if all this was history, people like me, my job would be much easier. All we would do is chronicle the time we were a racist country to the time we concluded that racism. And all these problems would be ameliorated. The reason why there's 22% poverty in Ferguson, and the reason why there's racial segregation in Ferguson, is because the Jim Crow era that we said has passed has just moved and transitioned into a new phase.
John in Brooklyn, I want to bring you into the conversation. What do you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say this whole situation in Ferguson, it also correlates in what's happening in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And the temperature in Crown Heights is really tense. For the last week, they've been arresting young black boys riding bicycles. Those are the people they're targeting. Children. They're targeting children riding bicycles. And as the Caribbean parade comes up for Labor Day, they have to walk very careful because the temperature in Brooklyn, especially Crown Heights, it's really hot. I'm among the community. I'm hearing these guys are talking. They're abusing the young black kids. I don't know if they're scared of the kids, but I don't see them arresting any white kids. I know it's a black community, but we have a Jewish community right next door.
Yeah, and it's a quickly changing neighborhood, Crown Heights.
But what's provoking, they're handling little kids. These kids are teenagers, 14, 15, riding on the sidewalk, asking for ID. These guys don't have ID. They're kids, right?
John, let me ask you, in Crown Heights, one of the things Peniel Joseph was talking about is who are the leaders? Are there leaders in Crown Heights that are watching the situation, that are communicating with law enforcement and saying, we're noticing this and we're very concerned?
Yeah, we had a guy came through there. He's a community organizer, and he hand out cards to everyone. And he suggests that we use our camera, our phones, to videotape what the situation. But, I did some videotaping with my cell phone, but it was no good. So right now I'm walking with my HD camera because it's an everyday thing. It's happening every day, and as you're around Crown Heights, you can pick up these situations. You know, you can see it. It's happening, and everybody notice it. And I'm letting everybody know. Everybody need to stay calm, especially as this parade comes up, and the police has to be very careful on how they handle the black community because the temperature is hot. I don't think they see it. I don't think they're aware of it. But I think they should be very careful, especially what's happening around the country.
John, thank you for your call. The temperature is hot in Crown Heights, he says. Peniel Joseph, what do you think about that?
Well, I think what's going on in Crown Heights and also what's going on in Ferguson and really around the country in terms of police and local black community conflicts is really based on the fact that, again, a lot of times our law enforcement, and I was born and raised in New York City, and we see what happened with the man who was, you know, choked to death recently, and Abner Louima, and there was Howard Beach. There's been so many incidents in New York City. But when the police don't think of the residents as part of a community that they're serving and that they're trying to protect, you really have police who are looking upon citizens as predators and as enemy combatants. So I thought one of the striking images of Ferguson, because there's only 21,000 people there, was the fact that I thought to myself that this police chief and these officers, right, you know, all white except maybe two or three black officers, they would not do this in the communities where people look like them. They just wouldn't do it. Like if you told them, look, this is your suburban community, this, you know, 97% white, we're going to bring tanks out on the street here, they'd say, no, I'm not going to do it because I actually know the women and children who live in this community. I go to church around here. I'm not going to run a tank through my neighborhood. So the problem here is the way in which they're looking upon black people, even though these black people are American citizens and local residents. That doesn't matter. And, of course, that happens in Brooklyn. It happens in Chicago. It happens in Boston. So there's a real major problem. And the only way we could fix that problem is if you had, one, at the federal level, a real policy of urban renewal, but then at the state and local level, you would transform residential and school segregation, because part of the problem is race and class and poverty, but a huge part of the problem is the segregation and the Jim Crow that we battled in the 1940s and 50s and 60s has persisted. That's the huge part. So even though there are liberal communities where they think they're integrated because maybe there's 10% black population, places like Cambridge, parts of Brooklyn, and I mean Cambridge, Massachusetts, not Maryland, parts of Los Angeles. For the most part, we live and work and die in rigidly segregated America. The only groups that are integrated at times are, you know, liberal and progressive elites who choose to congregate with one another, right? But people go to different schools. At schools, You know, campuses tend to be residentially, culturally segregated as well. So we're not speaking to each other, and we're also not looking upon each other as human beings. And for black people, that's always deadly when people aren't looking at them as human beings. And the fact that these young kids are being targeted is not a surprise. I think one of the good things that Obama said yesterday was the fact that our young people are getting punished at a higher level than their white counterparts in public schools and even private schools. And he's trying to use my brother's keeper to look at that. It doesn't have enough resources. But the interesting part about that is that when we think about the public school to prison pipeline, we have young black kids who've been arrested and taken out of schools in handcuffs, and they're 5 years old. I mean, what is up with that? That's crazy. That's insanity, right? And that's happening at a bigger rate than 50 years ago when the Civil Rights Act was passed. So how do you measure racial progress? Because if you measure it by the way in which black kids are being treated in the United States, you'd have to say things were better 50 years ago than today.
David in Belleville, New Jersey, has something to add to that. David, welcome to WNYC. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add that although the guest makes some good points, most of what he's saying is absolute nonsense.
Wait, what do you mean?
And I hope that you'll let me speak. The real problem in the black community is the lack of fathers in the household. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I mean in some tough neighborhoods, It is so bad now. My brother still lives in Chicago. Most of those neighborhoods, when I go back to visit, I have to go in the early morning because they are so dangerous, much more dangerous than they were in the 60s and 70s when there were gangs everywhere. And what we have tried to do for 40 years, and that is replace government with fathers. Even when I grew up, even in some bad neighborhoods, I'm hard-pressed to find a household that I grew up in a neighborhood where there wasn't a father present. And this is the problem that must be addressed, and nobody talks about it. As far as education, why have we supported school systems that are essentially dropout factories? Give every one of these kids that wants one a voucher and let them go to the school of their choice, just like middle class and upper middle class black folks do every day, and then you'll see some change. As long as we support systems that have failed our kids for decades, there will be no change.
All right, David, thank you for your call. Peniel Joseph, what about that government trying to replace fathers with government in the black community?
Well, no, I mean, I don't think that's true. I think that one of the things that's happened, and, you know, even conservatives like Charles Murray, who I often disagree with, have, you know, published books about, you know, white people in the white community and they're having more single-parent families. The idea of marriage certainly has been transformed in the last 50 years, but I don't think it's just a lack of fathers. I think the biggest problem when you have a lack of fathers among poor people is connected to income, because one of the things that we're not thinking of is what about people who are well-off who actually decide to have kids on their own? If that person has a support structure and a network that of child care, health care, income, a good place to live, a good job, and a good community for that child, the child's going to be fine. So what we're talking about when we think about, it's not necessarily the makeup of the family. And this goes back to Daniel Patrick Moynihan and matriarchy theses and demonizing black women for really, you know, taking care of the black family and not talking about why so many black men left families is because they actually don't have educations. Many of them are in prison, parole, probation, and they don't see a way of living in terms of, you know, middle-class American society. They don't see those opportunities. So no one ever tried to replace fathers with government. All people tried to do when we think about the 60s is say that young people should have health care, public schools should be excellent, people who were on welfare should not be demonized and disrespected, you know, Reagan's Welfare Queens from 1976 campaign. And right now in the 21st century, when we think about the family structure of the black community, the biggest problem the black community faces is one of poverty and a lack of resources. What people do because they don't want to address the lack of resources, is you focus on behavior and the makeup of the family. Okay, so that's a classic bait and switch. The saddest part is that some black people do the same thing, right? So you focus on a young black boy who's wearing baggy pants, right, and how those pants look, instead of saying, can this boy read and write, you know? Does he have a curfew? Is he being fed three times a day, right? Because one of the things we've seen with even NCAA athletes is they're saying they're going to bed hungry because there were these different warped rules about them having access to food. But there's so many black kids who go to bed hungry and have food scarcity or food insecurity every single day of their lives. So that's a bigger issue than sort of a lack of fathers. Certainly, I think, you know, we should have young black men who have kids should take care of their fathers. That's not the point that we're disputing. It's just this notion that fatherlessness equals a negative outcome. It's really poverty and a lack of resources, a lack of role models and really structures that equals the negative outcomes that we see, whether it's in a place like Ferguson or Crown Heights, Brooklyn, or nationally.
So thinking about class and economic isolation as we watch the scenes unfolding in Ferguson, Missouri, Tufts historian Peniel Joseph, thanks so much for joining us again on The Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll look at credit scores and how the calculation for them is changing, and it might just be good for you. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer.